Okay, I'll skip the introductions today. I'm going to talk about measuring and understanding poverty and draw on the two papers that were made available. The first is Becky Blank's paper, How to Improve Poverty Measurement in the United States. The second is a little paper I wrote called Fighting Poverty Revisited. And I'll tie the two together because whether or not you think there is a role for government policy will depend on how you interpret measured poverty and the effects of previous government programs. So, for example, just to foreshadow what's in the papers, if we spend a lot of money on the earned income tax credit, which provides cash to working poor families with children, but we have an official poverty measure that does not count the value of in-kind transfers, one might be led to look at the official data and say, well, we've been expanding the earned income tax credit. The poverty rate hasn't fallen, so let's get rid of the earned income tax credit. It's a wasteful program. So while poverty measurement is arcane and can be very boring, one can literally read hundreds of pages about statistical issues and choices that one can make when using, say, the American Community Survey data to measure poverty. It is important to understand what you're doing, and for certain purposes, you might decide that the variable the census gives you is fine. For other purposes, you might decide to do some different computations yourself. So measurement is important ultimately because our understanding of poverty is going to be affected by our measure of poverty. So today I'm going to start out talking about measurement issues, spend a little bit of time on that, move on to a review of economic and public policy factors that have affected the trend in poverty since the war on poverty, and essentially ask why is the official poverty rate today roughly the same as it was 35 years ago? And again, depending on one's answer to that question, one might decide there is a role for government or there's not a role for government. I want to conclude that there is, and so I'll end with some what I think are promising anti-poverty policies. Let me also, like Steve yesterday, encourage you to interrupt me as I go along. So here's some quotes from the Blank paper that's been distributed. And that first one is a pretty good statement of why there's not agreement among experts in the area. Poverty is an inherently vague concept, and developing a poverty measure requires a number of relatively arbitrary assumptions. And in fact, both Becky and I were on the National Academy of Sciences panel, so both of us think that the panel's report is a good one, and people who are interested in this issue should read the report. The report itself is about several hundred pages, but there is an executive summary of a reasonable length, which I thought I had, but don't seem to have with me. But even the National Academy of Science panel ended up saying things like, well, you could do this or you could do that. And in Becky's paper, she basically now says it's time for the federal government to set up a mechanism by which these final choices are made and a new poverty measure is adopted. Becky, in the second quote, has what I think would be a standard view among poverty researchers. That is, living in poverty suggests that a family has so little income that they are unable to purchase the things that we as a society think they need for a minimally decent life. Now, where you get into disagreements, and there's a counter view that says, no, poverty is really extreme deprivation. We see poverty in developing countries, and the United Nations uses a dollar a day as its measure, rough measure of poverty in less developed countries. The U.S. measure is much more than that. And so if you read work at the Heritage Foundation by, say, Robert Rector, you'll find him saying that what Becky is talking about isn't really poverty, it's a minimally decent life. And that in his view, poverty researchers are exaggerating the extent of poverty in the U.S. because he thinks there are more absolute standards that one could use. That I think, obviously, Becky agrees. He would say this is arbitrary, but it leads to a measure that's too high. So the official measure, which was developed by Molly Orshansky, a researcher at the Social Security Administration in the early 1960s, in part, she was doing the right research at the right time and became famous for the development of this index, although even 15 or so years after the development of it, she was one of the people who was in favor of making changes. Because she was writing in the early 1960s, the latest data she had was a 1955 economy food plan. If you go back and look at that, this was, I guess, what one would call nutrition science. The original plans have things like, well, men weigh more than women, so men need to eat more than women. And if you look at it, it would say so many eggs a week and so many pounds of potatoes and so many pounds of meat. And so when we first got a poverty measure, the poverty line for women was lower than men. Now, that was done away with in the early 1980s, saying, you know, it's politically incorrect to say that the poverty line ought to be lower for a woman than it is for a man. But it was based on the notion that these poverty measures came from these economy food plans. And kids, obviously, young kids eat less than adults. Teenagers, anybody who's had one knows, probably eats more. And so these were detailed food budgets. The notion was that typical families spent about a third of their income on food, and so basically the poverty line was this food budget, which was specific commodities priced multiplied by three. What's probably important is that the poverty line at that time came out to be about $3,000 of income, which is what most of the analysts working in the Johnson administration thought was a reasonable poverty line. So Orshansky had a measure which was based on some social science, but I suspect that if her measure had come up with a $5,000 line using these foods budgets, it wouldn't have been adopted. In any case, it's been updated since then only for prices. So to the extent that over time there is real income growth by definition is when the economy grows faster than inflation. So if in a good year prices rise by 2% and the economy grows by 3%, the poverty line would go up by 2%. So over time, you would think that with growing real living standards, the poverty line would fall as it has in the U.S. Relative to the median family income. As I say, if the income of each family doubles, the official poverty rate will fall because some families will be raised above the fixed line. And that's part of the notion that gets expressed in policy, is that the best way to reduce poverty is to grow the economy. And so if the economy grows and everybody's income grows, then poverty, by definition, will fall. If the economy grows, but all the growth is accrued to people with high incomes, then there need not be a fall in poverty as the economy grows. And to foreshadow the second part of my talk, that's indeed what's happened a lot after the 1970s, is that the income growth has been concentrated at the top. So these basically are the poverty measures today. You can see where you or your friends or family might be. The poverty line for a single non-elderly person is about $10,000. The poverty line is slightly lower for the elderly. Again, this comes about due to the food difference. A single mother with two children, about $16,000, and a married couple with two children, about $20,000. These lines, while criticized, one indication that they can still be useful is that when Congress decides who's eligible for public programs, they've often used a multiple of the poverty line. So I believe food stamps, you can have income as long as it's below 130% of the poverty line. I believe Medicaid is as long as your income is below 185% of the poverty line. School lunch uses another indicator. I don't remember what that is. So one of the ways that Congress has gotten around the issue is to keep the official poverty measure, but to make program eligibility based on a multiple. So, for example, I would think that if we adopted a poverty line according to the principles laid out in Becky Blank's talk, that would be a poverty line that was higher than the current line. And if that were the case, let's say arbitrarily the new poverty line comes out to be 130% of the old one, I would guess that Congress might then say, okay, now food stamp eligibility is less than 100% of the new poverty line. So one can distinguish what might be considered the target group for a government program, even when they use the official poverty line, by altering this percentage standards. I've alluded to some of the problems of the official poverty measure. Many of these were perfectly reasonable for Molly Olshansky not to have considered because they came in since the measure was developed. There really wasn't a nationwide food stamp program, school lunch program, or earned income tax credit. So it wasn't surprising that the Census Bureau, which had been measuring money income since the late 1940s, that Molly Olshansky would have a poverty measure based on census money income. All of these non-cash programs have grown over the last 40 years. And at least the first three are not controversial because they're either cash or near cash. Medicare and Medicaid are quite controversial. In Becky Blank's paper, she argues that we should have a separate measure. But if you think about it, a family that has, let's say we're a married couple with two kids, and one family has $19,000 of income and Medicaid, okay, they'd be counted as poor. Another family has $21,000 of income and no health insurance. They'd be counted as not poor using this. It's quite controversial to figure out how to value medical insurance, but what you might end up saying is, well, the first person is income poor, and the second person is health insurance poor. And when Blank talks about other dimensions, that's one of the things she's talking about. Or one might try the more complicated version of including medical care expenditures. But I think there's no controversy about the near cash benefits that they should be counted. Similarly, there's a consensus that we should subtract taxes paid by the poor. Again, they weren't very important when Molly Orshansky was writing, but today in some states food is taxed by a sales tax of 7, 8, 9%, the poor can pay a substantial amount of their income in sales taxes. And so there's a consensus that if we're going to add tax credits like the earned income tax credit, we should also subtract taxes paid. The National Academy thought that we should also subtract work-related child care and transportation expenses. Again, child care, which is something which has grown in importance over time. There's always an argument about geographical differences, and it's probably politically the one that would be the hardest to get across, in part because the political ramifications are so perfectly clear to the people who would have to vote on this. So not surprisingly, Senator Moynihan of New York, when he was alive and in the Senate, was a big fan of adjusting for prices, because obviously prices in New York are relatively high, and if you adjust prices, then the poverty line will go up in New York, and there'll be more poor New Yorkers. And because prices are much lower in Mississippi, then the poverty line will go down in Mississippi. And so adjusting for geographical differences will have big differences across country in who's eligible for public programs. Now, to the extent that this is a problem for the measure of poverty, I also point out it's a problem for the measure of income taxes, because when you pay your income tax, the person living in New York City who earns $30,000 is going to pay the same income tax as the person earning $30,000 in Mississippi. And if you did this adjustment for incomes, both for the purposes of measuring poverty and for taxes, you would again have this change, which would favor people in high-income areas. A number of economists believe that this sorts itself out through mobility, because if you don't like the high housing prices in New York, you can always move to Mississippi where the housing prices are lower, or that the wages you earn in New York reflect these geographical differences in cost. Becky is pretty strong. She labels the thresholds nonsensical. The National Academy of Science suggested something that is Orshansky-like, but rather than food, food, shelter, clothing, and a little more. And this notion of a little more was one of the choices where the committee said, well, it could be 10 to 15% more. And it wasn't just food spending. It's also not updated only for prices, but for changes in expenditures, which tend to go up on these necessities less than income, but more than prices. Outdated concept of the income family, income sharing unit. Those of you who are sociologists, cohabitation has increased dramatically. We only measure poverty based on people to whom you are related by blood, marriage, and adoption. And so as of 6 months ago, my son and his girlfriend were living together. Let's say he was working, she was in school, he'd be non-poor, she'd be poor. They got married recently. Nothing changed. All of a sudden, she goes from being poor to non-poor because now they're a married couple, not two individuals. When there's two individuals, he would be compared to his income. She would be compared to her income. If she's a student and it's very low, she would be counted as poor. Again, this was not something that Orshansky had to worry about because cohabitation wasn't a big issue in the early 1960s. I mentioned some of these measurement problems and how they affect our analysis, our understanding of poverty. If you don't count programs that clearly benefit the poor, then you overstate poverty and you understate the effectiveness of government programs. And indeed, a critique of the right, and I would refer you to the website of the Heritage Foundation. They have things like over $5 trillion has been spent on government programs and poverty remains high, so we should get rid of many of these programs. And unless you count the benefits and reduce measured poverty, then you're not going to see the true effect of these government programs. On the other hand, Blank argues, and most people agree, the National Academy agreed, that the poverty threshold after more than 40 years understates the extent of poverty compared to a poverty line that would have increased over time as suggested by the NAS panel. I'm going to suggest, when I show you a little data, or if you've read my article, it's in there, that the two, when done right, or reasonably, the two probably cancel themselves out. So if you both raised the threshold and counted all the income, you would probably end up with a poverty rate that's not too different from the current poverty rate, but you'd be showing that government provided more income to people who are below the poverty line, and that obviously raising the poverty line would bring other people under the line. So you would be bringing some people into poverty who aren't now poor, who are now not counted as poor, but other people would be taken out because you'd be adding to their incomes these non-cash benefits. I gave you an example, the non-counting of cohabitation overstates the extent of poverty to the extent that cohabitors share income. Basically, we assume for purposes of poverty measurement that income is shared only among people related by blood, marriage, and adoption. So the NAS recommendations were to add in-kind transfers, subtract federal, state, and local income and payroll taxes, add the earned income tax credit and other refundable tax credits, subtract work-related child care and transportation. The net effect of all that is to add money to the incomes of many poor people, and then the thresholds would also go up. Yeah? Well, it's very interesting. The NAS thought that what you needed to do was spend more money on the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which comes out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that's where you get median expenditures of two adult, two children families on basic necessities. That comes out of the BLS. You could do it two ways, and the Census Bureau, in fact, has been, you could go to the website of the Census Bureau and they published, at least until recently in the Bush administration, estimates, I think they're called alternative estimates of poverty based on the National Academy of Science. In some case you simply ask people, the CPS asked you, last year did you get money from unemployment insurance? How much? Last year did you get money from dividends? If so, how much? Then they'd ask, did you get money from food stamps? How much? Did you get an earned income tax credit? How much? Now, there's underreporting and misreporting of all income concepts in the census. They do best on earnings, which is a number most people know more. If you were to ask me about things other than earnings, if Ren, as the census taker, came to my house, I would say, wait a minute, let me go get my taxes for last year, and I can read it up. But most people don't necessarily do that. So even business income is underreported. We know that government income is underreported. If there were no census confidentiality rules, then the simple thing to do would be to get your Social Security number and match it up to food stamp records, AFDC records, and merge it. So the measurement issues aren't going to go away either under the current measure, because welfare transfers are underreported in the CPS and presumably the ACS. But this measure does increase the demands for information and would raise the cost and difficulty. So for example, work-related child care expenses, the committee proposed a cap of what they thought was a reasonable amount, because you, again, some people might decide, let's say you have a relatively high-income family which hires a nanny, you're not going to say, well, for the purpose of poverty measurement, we're going to let you subtract $20,000 a year for child care costs. So I forget the detailed number, but the NAS panel said child care up to X. I think in the 90s it was $200 a month, but I don't. Well, it wouldn't have been low in the 90s. It was reasonable in the 90s when we did it. And the same thing about transportation. I think the notion was you'd get some estimate of what's a reasonable amount of transportation, but then presumably when the price of gas goes from $2 to $4, there would then be an adjustment. And this year, if poor people are driving more and spending more on gas and utilities, there's no effect on the poverty rate, whereas presumably you'd have a mechanism to do it. So one of the reasons it's been very difficult to change the poverty measure, and Becky's paper is quite good about it, is once you open this up there, unless you were going to say, okay, we're going to appoint a nonpartisan commission and adopt their recommendation, getting this thing in a way that's non-controversial is going to be very, very difficult. There was even a West Wing about changing the poverty measure, and somebody made the case you really should do it, the measure's outdated, and then the bottom line, well, this is going to show that poverty's going up. Well, we don't want to have poverty go up on our watch, so let's forget about it. This is bad politics. And I'm old enough to remember when I was a postdoc at Wisconsin, a number of people were working on the 1976 HEW Commission on Redefining the Poverty Rate, which put out 15 or 16 little paperback volumes. I think I have them in a box somewhere. And there was sort of one on geographic differential. And, you know, nothing came out of that one either. Right. So Social Security benefits go up every year by inflation, but the minimum wage doesn't.
Right.
And so you have all sorts of anomalies that and they have health care as well, right? So on the other hand, the committee, the most controversial aspect of the NAS was, should you subtract, just as you subtract work-related child care and transportation expenses, should you subtract out-of-pocket medical expenses that aren't covered by insurance? And for the elderly, particularly before Medicare Part D, which just went into effect in the last year or two, those numbers were large. So a very, very large can of worms. I think I'm not going to, since I want to talk substance, I'll very quickly just say that the Europeans basically get around all of this by using a relative poverty measure. The Europeans think we're strange. I actually think the Europeans are strange. And the reason is because if everybody's income doubles, there's no change in poverty. And so if you think about a recent case of dramatic income changes, it's Ireland, which has had a real economic growth miracle over the last 20 years. And I forget the paper, but I was at a conference several years ago when somebody was saying, oh, you know, the real income in Ireland has gone up by 50% in the last 10 years. And if we measured poverty the way the Americans do, the poverty rate would have gone from 16% to 5%. But of course, that's silly because everybody's income went up. So the relative poverty measure only fell from 16% to 14%. So I raised my hand and I said, I think that's silly. If I'm the Irish government and all this income came, you know, at least you ought to have both a relative measure, which is a measure of inequality. It says the poor didn't gain relative to everybody else because everybody's income in Ireland was growing. But the poor certainly are a lot better off than they were before this growth spurt. So the NAS measure is quasi-relative and tries to go somewhere in the middle of this. The issue is whether how you're doing relative to the Joneses is a measure of inequality. And nothing says you can't have both measures. So what I do have here are some quotes from Robert Lampman, who was very involved in the initial war on poverty programs, and particularly the measurement of income. He was an economist who worked for the Council of Economic Advisers in the Johnson administration. And he was very explicit, and that's why I have it in red. He actually always said income poverty, and implying that what you want is to focus on what people have. And so your statement was really, well, isn't it a relative matter? It matters. And so he said, I don't think we should engage in frequent changes other than to adjust for prices. He also thought the measure we had was going to be zero by 1980. So his view was, you get a measure, it tells you how well people are. So let's say his vision, then you say, okay, by 1980, the absolute measure which we adopted in the war on poverty is zero. Let's say we've done a great job. Now let's think in 1980, not yet 1980, but 1990, maybe a cell phone is 2000, a computer is a necessity, a cable TV, whatever, that these notions of what a minimally decent standard is changes. And so he was basically arguing you shouldn't do it every year, which was what a relative poverty measure does. So if you think about it, an absolute poverty measure never changes, so it goes up zero with relative income, with real income. A relative poverty measure goes up one for one. If income's doubled, the poverty line doubles. The National Academy was trying to be somewhere in the middle, and there's some argument that the NAS made based on subjective measures and things that that's what people tend to think of. So, you know, again, the war on poverty focus, as early as the mid-70s, people weren't making this distinction between income poverty and poverty, leading to what I would say is a political confusion that continues. Yeah. Well, not surprisingly, there were people who thought it was too low and people who thought it was too high. The people who thought it was too low said that's supposed to be an emergency food plan. The people who thought it too high, notably Milton Friedman and his wife Rose Friedman, have an article saying, well, if the typical person spends a third of their income on food, the poor should be expected to spend more because they should be spending more on necessities. So the multiplier ought to be 2 and the poverty line ought to be 2,000. So when it was adopted, there were... And that's why you're not going to get out of this. So you change the food plan. I change the multiplier. We can end up back at the same place. And that's why I think in that first quote from Blank, I quoted that it's basically arbitrary, because we're going to disagree on the multiplier, we're going to disagree. So should cohabitors be counted as sharing less than spouses, but more than boarders? I mean, now we treat cohabitors as boarders, we treat spouses as sharing equally. Should that be? So for every decision you make, you've got a reasonable wiggle room. So this is not rocket science. I think I'll skip that. So let me talk about, move on to the second part and talk about, in some sense, why I would argue that the government spending has not been wasted, and that the way to move forward is by recognizing that we live in a changed economy, and that to reduce poverty requires additional government spending. So in the boom that lasted really from the end of World War II to the oil price shock of the early 1970s, we had very rapid economic growth. We had rapid growth of wages for all workers throughout the wage distribution. The wages of low-wage workers actually grew somewhat more than those of higher-wage workers in percentage terms. More workers over this period got health insurance and pensions on their jobs. We had rapidly falling poverty, slowly falling inequality, a modest trend away from two-parent families, increases in the inflation-adjusted minimum wage, and a rapid increase in social spending due to the war on poverty and Great Society. So almost all of these factors, except the modest trend away from two-parent families, were poverty-reducing. So we had economic and public policy changes that were strongly poverty-reducing. Since then, we've had slower economic growth and rising inequality, and by now most people know this. We have a big difference between the economic status of men and women over this period. For men, particularly for less skilled workers, and this ties into the Steve Raphael talk yesterday where he talked about workers with a high school degree or less, falling real wages. There's been, in fact, no wage growth for the median worker. I'll show you some numbers soon. And rapid growth for top earners. The loss of unionized manufacturing jobs that were the ones that in the post-war boom provided good wages, health insurance, and pensions for less educated men. And so a dramatic change in this last 35 years compared to the 25 or so years after World War II. For women, it's quite different. The women's situation looks much more like men did in the post-war boom, and that is there's increased work and earnings for most workers. So women at all levels of education have worked more over the past 35 years, and their wages tended to have kept up or exceeded inflation, where it's the not the case for men. No decline in poverty except for the elderly, and Lisa mentioned why. That's Social Security. And basically, the official poverty rate has fluctuated around 11% for the last 35 years. Although, I guess 2008 is shaping up to be a year when poverty is likely to increase more than usual, but we will get the 2007 poverty rate right around Labor Day, usually when it comes out. I suspect 2007 is still a small increase in poverty relative to 2006. Substantial increases in income inequality independent of the business cycle. Over this period, rapid increases in divorce and non-marital childbearing, rapid increases in immigration, and whether or not you accept Steve Raphael's view from yesterday's talk, Steve's view was that immigrants aren't a big force reducing the wages of native workers. Nonetheless, the fact that there are more immigrants mean that there are more low-wage workers. So the composition effect of immigration is to raise poverty. So the demographic supply changes are much worse in this period. And there's a decline in the inflation-adjusted minimum wage and a slowdown in the growth of transfers for the non-elderly poor, with the exception of the EITC. But the EITC isn't in the official poverty measure. So in the previous 25 years after the 25 years after World War II, almost all of these factors were poverty reducing. In the last 35 years, many of them have been poverty increasing. The biggest factor that's poverty reducing is women, their increased work and earnings. So here are three alternative poverty measures. The blue line is the official line. And the red line says, what if the official measure were 25% higher than it currently is? And that's probably the level that a National Academy of Science measure might end up today, about 25% higher than the official measure. But the green line shows what happens when you add the transfers that are not counted. And again, this is very rough, but basically raising the poverty line would add about 4 percentage points to poverty, and counting all the income that's non-controversial would reduce poverty by about 4 percentage points. These big forces are operating in this post-World War II boom, which takes you right down to 1973, 1974. You had basically uninterrupted falls in poverty. And then basically since then, you're moving in a narrow range. This is the recession in the early 80s when unemployment got to 10%. This is the recession in the early 90s. You got poverty back to 15%, even though unemployment, quote, only got to 7.5%. This was the Reagan economic boom. This was the Clinton economic boom. But you don't see anything like this kind of sustained decline. And let me just jump ahead. This would be my argument about the best indication that the economy has changed. If you look from 1960 to 1973, the real earnings of men who work full-time, full year, so this gets rid of the notion that, well, some people are poor because they're unwilling to work. These are men working full-time, full year, so they're clearly willing to work. The red line is women. But this is an increase roughly from $30,000 to $40,000 in 15 years. So that's 12 over 29 is about a 35% real growth in wages in that period. Well, there's been no growth in median male earnings over the last 30 years. And to me, that's the story. And it's got nothing to do with the behavioral responses of the poor who are too dependent on government to work. It has to do with, if this is what the median full-time man earns, what does, and I'll show you in a minute the difference, you know, what does a high school dropout earn? Women, though, look more like men over the whole period in that 17,000 to 23,000, and it continues to 31,000. So you've got a third over this period, and then a quarter or 30% over a longer period. So the growth rate has been slower for women, but still marching upwards. Manufacturing workers aren't going to drive this as much as you think.
Okay.
Clearly, I mean, I think Wren probably knows this for Detroit, but if I recall, since I did a little work on Detroit with Wren, 1950 or 1960 was the peak real earnings for men in the Detroit metro area. And so the decline there has been going on for a long time, in part because of the changing auto industry. But again, we were involved in a four-city project, and I don't remember the numbers, but there was Atlanta, and Atlanta certainly boomed over the last 30 years in a way that Detroit has declined, and you'll still find this. The real earnings of many male workers have not kept up with inflation. And I don't know enough to say whether, you know, you look at policemen or firemen or post office workers. So it's not, you know, this is all men in the U.S., the median earnings. When you look at, and I don't think I have the education detail here, these are sort of the production workers. So this is closer to what you're talking about, and what you find for them is a relatively big decline with an increase after the Clinton boom, which seems to have slowed. This only goes to 2002. But nonetheless, these are production workers, so Wren and I and those of you who are assistant professors and postdocs are not in this table, whereas we would be in the median earnings of full-time workers, and this looks much worse than that. And so if the median is flat, you know, and I showed you college graduates, they would be going up, and that's part of this that was so different. I mean, maybe the issue was it's the post-war boom that was remarkable, that the earnings of blue-collar workers doubled and the earnings of college graduates doubled, so everybody... A rising tide really was lifting all boats, and this is very different recently. Again, this is, and I don't have this updated, but these are the percentage change in real hourly wages, where you take the lowest wage workers down here and the highest wage workers up here, and the dotted line is women and the solid line is men. So women are increasing their wage rates everywhere. And the bottom 35% of men have small losses, and this is the 45th percentile is zero, so you can see there's not much growth in the median, and that it's only when you get up to, you know, 75 or so percent, the top 25%, or particularly the top 5%, where you get these big increases. And if you do this for the previous period, you end up with, say, a flat line for men that looks like a very high number, 70% across the board kind of thing. Just another indication showing wages and salaries at different points in the income distribution, so not the median. So you can see men at the bottom going from 16,000 to 12,000, adjusting for inflation, at the top going from 88 to 117. When people talk about inequality, if you just do this ratio, 88 to 16 is roughly 5 to 1, 117 to 12 is almost 10 to 1. And these data, the CPS data, don't do a good job of getting at really high-income earners. So the increased inequality over this period is quite dramatic. You see, for women, increased inequality, not as rapid among men, but the big difference is you have increases everywhere, whereas you only have increases there at the top. So where does that leave us if I move to the third point? What are these stories about measurement and understanding why poverty hasn't changed much? What does it say about the prospects for reducing poverty? One of the big things that's different is we no longer have the political will. In part, it's because we no longer trust government to the extent that we trusted government in the War on Poverty era. It really, after the Vietnam War, faith in the ability to government to accomplish things declined dramatically. But you can see this was President Johnson's State of the Union address in 1964, and if you watch videos of it, there's some very good videos of that era on some PBS documentaries, you get a notion of optimism that I don't think you would hear a politician say today. In fact, every president from Nixon through Clinton talked about reforming welfare and changing the welfare system, and almost all of them began with an attack on the welfare system, but none of them proposed broad-scale anti-poverty measures of the kind that Johnson proposed here. And it's interesting because he was speaking at a time when the economy really was relatively prosperous. But he said general prosperity and growth leave untouched many of the roots of human poverty. Again, this is a few months later when he introduced the Economic Opportunity Act. Very, very optimistic that we could do this. Combination of moral belief and belief in the ability of government, because it is right, because it is wise, and because for the first time in our history it's possible to conquer poverty, I submit the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. Well, I don't have time to go into it, but obviously there was a long period of attack on government social programs, which gained steam at the beginning of the Reagan administration and probably culminated in the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, which ended up cutting back on the safety net for people who don't work. So the only example I have of a politician who was Johnson-esque was Tony Blair, who, like President Johnson, became very unpopular in the UK because of his support for an unpopular war, but actually did an enormous amount for domestic policy in the UK. And again, this, I'd say this is Johnson-esque. Our historic aim will be for ours to be the first generation to end child poverty, and it will take a generation. It's a 20-year mission, but I believe it can be done. So I find that Johnson-esque. He put in place a set of programs and policies. His soundbite was work for those who can, security for those who can't. Poverty declined dramatically in the UK. And in fact, most of the policies look like U.S. policies. So if you want to argue that the U.S. could take a set of policies and further reduce poverty, you can go to the United Kingdom. So we have an earned income tax credit. The U.K. now has a working families tax credit. but theirs turns out to be bigger than ours. Blair put in a minimum wage in the UK. They didn't have one before that. It started at less than £4. It's now close to £6. So it started at about the level of the US minimum wage in the late 90s, when the minimum wage here was $5.15 an hour. The minimum wage, I think it's $5.85 now, and it goes up in July, I think, to $6.15. There's an increase in July. So in the UK, it's gone up from less than £4 to about £6. So in the US, it will have gone up over this period, what's that, 75 cents or so, 15, 20%. In the UK, it's gone up 100% gradually over this period. And if people are interested in this, the best comparative work being done on this is by Jane Waldfogel of Columbia University, who's got a couple of papers on this and is currently writing a book on it. But it documents that these U.S.-style policies that Blair put into place have been successful in the U.K. And if that's the case, there's no reason that we couldn't re-import these back. He basically took a set of policies from the U.S. and shaped them to the U.K. that we couldn't re-import them and do similar things. So I'll close with what I consider to be a modest anti-poverty initiative to cut the U.S. poverty rate in half. I'd say among poverty researchers, these are not very controversial. If you look at what John Edwards proposed when he was running for president, a number of these things were in there. You might also look to the success of the Edwards campaign and say, we're not quite ready for Tony Blair here, because that was the centerpiece of the Edwards campaign. But the changes I have focused on are to make work pay, increased aid for the working poor, which is not controversial in the U.S. I don't have anything about raising welfare benefits for non-workers. I do have transitional jobs of last resort for those who don't qualify for unemployment insurance and those no longer entitled to cash welfare, so that there's a work for welfare safety net for those who want to work but can't find regular jobs. And obviously that would be a particular issue when the economy is in recession, as we seem to be getting close. Making work pay, you have to have a job and earn low wages to benefit from that. There are a lot of proposals for expanding the earned income tax credit, which have been put forward. Gordon Berlin has a particularly interesting proposal. Most analysts think the minimum wage needs to go back to where it was relative to the average wage, which would be about $7 now. Expanded state child health insurance to cover parents. Congress proposed such an expansion last fall, but it was vetoed by the president. One could also reduce poverty with making, we currently have a per child credit, but it's not refundable, so that if you don't pay taxes, it's not of benefit to many low-income families. And that's one way to help the non-working poor, because you would then, obviously, this wouldn't be considered as a welfare program, but as a child care credit. So what I've tried to do is argue that there is a tie between the mundane academic task of trying to define and measure poverty, and that depending on what one comes up with, as a measure, one can come away with very different interpretations of why poverty hasn't fallen very much or really at all since the early 1970s. And then finally, I've argued that if one looks beyond this issue, if one adopted a poverty measure that valued all the government benefits, we would see that government has done more over the last 40 years, and that it's the soundbite would be it, government had to run harder to stay in place, that the economy was generating more poverty, and the increased government was offsetting that, leading you with no change in poverty. So if the economy is going to continue to generate poverty, the answer is not to cut back on public programs, but to actually expand those, and that we know enough and can draw on the British example to do that if we had the political will. So what happened now is, after welfare reform, which I don't think we're going to turn back, you get a year of transitional Medicaid after you leave. So a woman leaves welfare or doesn't go on welfare these days, and she's got a low-wage job. She's working part-time at Walmart, and they don't, although they now say they're going to do more on health insurance, but she's working for somebody that doesn't provide health insurance. She's earning $14,000 a year. Her kid in all states will be able to get on SCHIP, but she won't. And the reason I picked Badger Care in Wisconsin is not just because I used to be in Wisconsin, but because that was put in place by Tommy Thompson, who was a Republican governor. So it's not a radical proposal. And basically it said, well, why don't we also cover the parents of the kids in SCHIP? Now, it got caught again in the soundbite that you're now covering people who ought to buy their own insurance, or people are going to give up their private insurance and come onto the public sector. And so that's why I have here a modest anti-poverty initiative to cut the U.S. poverty rate in half. It wouldn't do anything for people who have no insurance and don't have kids. Kids would be a lot better off if they didn't have their parents dragging them down in public opinion. The issue is there was a decline in, I think the big thing is the decline in the expectation that government can solve a problem. So I forget the guy's name. He was at Yale. He wrote a book, The Moon in the Ghetto. If we can send a man to the moon, which we showed we could do by putting all the bright minds, we can do the same to resolve urban problems. Well, nowadays, it's not just anti-poverty programs. We don't trust the post office. We go to Federal Express or UPS. We don't trust the public schools. We're going to private schools and charter schools. So I think, in general, there's been an increase in skepticism that even if government had the money, they would do it right. So that's one thing. Then the other is, in this post-World War II boom, most families were having a rising standard of living year after year, and so they might not have noticed. I mean, Johnson tried to pay for the war with the surtax. Now we don't even try to pay for the war with the surtax. So even on defense, we seem unwilling to spend the money which would be prudent economically to do. So part of that, I think, has to do with, in the World War II boom, people thought, oh, gee, this is a great country. Every year we're a little better off. And if you look back over the last 35 years, you could say the average family is only better off because it went from having 20% of the wives working to 60% of the wives working, or whatever the right numbers are. So that then there's not this capacity, and even, you know, under, I believe Obama is saying, I'll set back the Bush tax cut, but only for people with incomes over $250,000. That's less than 5% of the taxpayers. So you don't have the political will, you don't have the public trust in government, and you don't have the resources that people feel that they can use. Well, I'm not convinced that the declining concentration of poverty might have been mostly due to rising real wage rates of low-income workers in the 90s and expanded EITC. So the 90s is one period in which low-income people are getting some income gains. I have not been convinced that, you know, Hope 6 was big enough or had strong enough effects. And then there's the blowback from that. Again, you know more about this than I do, but some people are arguing it's the old urban renewal. You knock down Cabrini Green and X hundred people leave and you let a small number of them come back to the mixed income housing you have. So the city's got more revenue and that's a better area, but what happened to the people? They might have been concentrated there before and now they're scattered about, but their incomes and access to jobs hasn't necessarily gone up. So I think there's, in some sense, I think with the boom of the 90s, there was much less attention on concentrated poverty than there was, say, when Bill Wilson put this on the agenda in the late 80s. Well, I think the issue is phrased at the better the government program, the more likely the marginal employer is going to drop coverage. On the other hand, given the rising health costs, the marginal employer is dropping coverage. So how much of the employer drop in coverage is due to the fact that they say, oh, gee, if we drop coverage, most of our workers can get covered under Badger Care. That's not the case in Michigan. And so you'd look, and a test of it would be, are employers shedding health insurance as much in Wisconsin as Michigan? And the difference is, in Wisconsin, they've got a public program they can go to that they don't have here. What I hear is from lots of people who have worked for the university and they're then going off to go back to school or something, and they realized, okay, I'm covered under COBRA, and then they find out how much the university is paying per month for the health insurance. So, and part of it is because health insurance is not taxed, most of us don't know what our employers are paying for health insurance. I mean, the health insurance problem makes the poverty problem look simple. And that's because for the poverty problem, when you say something, you're going to expand the earned income tax credit for people without kids. We have an earned income tax credit. We know how to do it. It's simple. It doesn't affect many people. When you go to change the healthcare system, you're changing how doctors are paid and how hospitals are paid and how you or I who have insurance is going to have to line up. So I think the health insurance issue is really much more difficult and is probably the one that the public cares more about because there are more people who are uninsured than there are poor. I don't have the numbers here, but poverty hasn't gone down. It's gone up some. Uninsurance has been marching upward, and particularly if you didn't have this increase in public coverage, you would have an even bigger increase in uninsurance. So it's very much the same kind of thing. Every year, the number of people uninsured creeps up. The number of people insured by the public sector goes up. So we're doing a lot more coverage with Medicaid and SCHIP today than we did 20 years ago. But it's the same kind of thing. Do you conclude, oh, the problem is government programs, we should get rid of these and then everybody will buy their own policy? Workforce training programs like the post office and the public schools have a bad reputation. My friend and colleague Harry Holzer has a paper he's writing in which he's trying to say, please don't throw them away. There are many people who take the view that we know what to do with three-year-olds, and so we should invest in three-year-olds, but we don't know what to do with 19-year-old dropouts who read at the seventh grade level. So Holzer's paper does show there's been a tremendous decline in spending on employment and training programs over the last 40 years. They reached their peak. Wren mentioned summer job programs and things. In the late 70s under Carter, a very substantial percentage of the urban youth got summer jobs. Again, I don't remember the numbers now, but in some big cities it was like 25% of minority teenagers got summer jobs programs. Those all went away in the 80s and haven't come back. And so people are, I've got somebody who earned $12,000 last year. The poverty line is $14,000. If I give them a $3,000 EITC, they're out of poverty. If I give them a $3,000 voucher to get training, if it really worked, then that would pay off in the future. But again, the training programs we've had to date have worked much better for women than men. And so there's a whole discussion about what to do with disconnected men, and this goes back to Steve Raphael's other work, particularly men who are high school graduates or high school dropouts with very low basic reading and numeracy skills and a prison record. And there are experiments out there in the field, but not a lot of high payoffs. Most people hate it because if the post office can't deliver the mail, how are you going to have a jobs program? There are some transitional jobs programs now for ex-offenders and other low-skilled workers. The last time we did something like this was CETA in the late 70s and the early 80s. I think it's the only thing you can do. In other words, there was a story about Flint in the New York Times today. So, you were working as a waitress at Flint, and you've got a couple of kids, and in the old days you might have been able to go on welfare when the factory closes and the restaurant closes because nobody comes to lunch. You can't go back on welfare by and large, and so you've demonstrated that you're willing to work, so do you have some sort of low-wage job of last resort as a substitute for welfare? So you might say it would be cheaper just to write them checks, just the way it is to write the EITC, but we're not going to do that. So it is interesting, John Edwards had a huge transitional jobs of last resort program. Obama has a very small one, if you look at his website. And his is tied to, I think to make it more palatable, it's tied to behavioral changes. So mothers would be expected to go to parenting classes as part of the transitional jobs. And men would go to anti-domestic violence. So if you take a look at it, it's sort of it's not just a job which people say, oh, it'll be a make work job. But so there might be some experimentation. My reading of the programs that are currently operating for ex-offenders is that the transition period is too short, that people need longer transition periods because the negative effects of that kind of an educational criminal record are much harder to deal with. Yeah, no, that growth in earnings was due to the growth in the economy. So the economy was booming. I mean, it was a unusual period. We were not destroyed in the war, and so we were at full capacity selling things without a lot of competitors. And so the argument used to be the auto companies could raise the wages of auto workers and just raise the prices of cars. I've come to accept the fact that the economy is going to generate low wages for millions of workers, and there's not much government can do about it. So you can marginally increase the minimum wage. Can't raise the minimum wage to $12. Minimum wage won't work. The critics would be right. So you can marginally raise the minimum wage, and you can raise the EITC, and you can provide more health insurance to marginal workers. But, you know, when you can tax corporate executives so they don't get $10 billion, you know, they only get $2 billion. So you can do some offsetting, but I don't think anybody has the solution. And, you know, this is sort of Mary Jo Bain has a recent paper when she says, you know, the flip side of this is there's a boom in China and India, and so that looks like our post-World War II boom where wages are rising across the board. So if you think about the global economy, there's just no way where you can close it off in a way that, you know, the auto companies can't raise the wages of workers and raise the prices of cars. In fact, they got to cut the prices of car to try to get people to take it off their hands. Well, we don't do that. I mean, it's not my area. My understanding is we provide less government money as foreign aid than do other countries, you know, as a percentage of GDP. It's not my area, but, you know, people will say the Nordic countries in Japan pay a bigger percent to unconstrained foreign aid than we do. We do provide more in private charities, which people say, well, that people don't trust the government, but they're still good people. So I don't think it's the case. I think you could get rid of all the foreign aid and it wouldn't make a dent in the amounts of money that are needed or relative to what other countries spend. I mean, we tax ourselves less and we spend less. So in some sense, we've got a system that works in a way that's different from a number of other countries. Well, it's actually relatively small. I mean, the military is
140,000.
Yeah, but the military is smaller now than it has been. I mean, that's why they got into problems, because they didn't have enough soldiers. They're running these guys tour after tour. So the percentage of men who were in the labor force who probably went through Vietnam is much bigger than the percentage today. Now, I think there was a bill that was passed to provide more GI benefits. What I thought you might say is we also know that the disability payments are going to be very high, and so those will get paid, and I think nobody knows what the costs are likely to be. They're likely to be very high, and that's another source of they're going to go and get veterans' disability payments, and that's got to come. Those payments have got to come from somewhere. I don't know is the right answer. I think in the early 90s, after 20 years of slow economic growth and rising inequality, we got a big boom. And poverty fell and wages fell, and things were pretty, I mean, the economy in 1999 was terrific. Low unemployment, rising wages across the board, a budget surplus. So, there may be a biotech or an information tech revolution that will greatly increase all of our productivity. That's unforeseen. So, I think it's 4:30. I've kept you guys long enough, and you probably have homework problems that Al and Ren and Lisa have assigned. So thanks for your attention.